It's funny, this one. Okay, today is February 26, 2011. We're in the Kinsley Library. Joan Weaver and Rosetta Graff will be interviewing Donna Newsom. Donna, what is your full name?
Donna Ray Scott Newsom.
And where do you currently reside?
1072 210th Avenue, Lewis.
And when and where were you born?
I was born July 17, 1941, in St. Louis Hospital in Great Bend.
And what were the names of your parents?
My mother's name, do you want her maiden name?
Mm-hmm.
My mother's name was Ethel Mae Massey, and my father's name was Donald Raymond Scott.
And the names of your grandparents?
My maternal grandparents were Millie and Truman Massey. And my father's parents, I have to stop and think for a minute because his mother died when he was 11. Her name was Betsy, and his father's name was Raymond Scott. And then his father remarried a woman named Delia.
And can you describe the makeup of the household you grew up in? Brothers, sisters, that sort of thing?
Well, I was kind of estranged growing up because I was raised by my grandparents. When I was 11 months old, I need to back up just a little bit because my mother had a sister who was 8 years older than she. Her name was Thelma, and she was killed in a car wreck by Garden City. Her husband, Thelma's husband, was a coach, Cliff Benz, and they left. She left a five-year-old daughter. And my Uncle Cliff was a coach, and he didn't know what he was going to do, so he gave my maternal grandparents, Millie and Truman Massey, Kay, to raise, and she was five, and that was just about the same time that my mother gave me at age 11 months to my grandparents. My mother did this because my father enlisted in the, I believe it was the Army Air Force at that time, and my mother wanted to go on. She was very, very, very bright and very musically talented, and she wanted to go on to college. And so my grandparents took my cousin Kay at five and myself at 11 months. So it was different.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what brought you or your grandparents or whatever to Lewis?
What brought my grandparents to Lewis?
Well, whoever was here first.
Well, they were here before I was.
Right. Yeah, well, yeah.
It is interesting. My grandparents, my great-grandparents on the Massey side, came from just over the line into West Virginia, I believe it was. And I'm trying to figure, it must have been in the 1890s, perhaps. My great-grandfather brought my granddad Truman and his older brother Floyd, and they traveled by train. And they got off at Garfield and looked the land over and purchased some land and then moved the entire family by train to this location, and they had a family home on the county line. The Massey family did. My grandmother came from Wayne County, Kentucky, a family of, all the children weren't born at that time, but it turned out to be a family of 10. Her father went through the Oklahoma land rush and acquired some land around Nowata, Oklahoma.
Around where?
Nowata, N-O-W-A-T-A.
And if you're spelling things, Massey is spelled?
M-A-S-S-E-Y.
Okay. We will stop and do that sometimes for our transcriber.
Right, right. And I had many interesting stories. My great-grandparents on the McClendon side, that was my grandmother's maiden name.
And you say it's spelled McClendon?
M-C-C-L-E-N-D-O-N. They lived to be in 96 and 97, so as a high school student, I spent a lot of time with my grandmother going down there and was able to visit with them and to listen to the stories of going through that period of history. My great-grandma would tell how the Indians would, they had a little soddy first, and the Indians would run the horses over the top of it trying to break down the roof, you know, or set fire. The prairie grass was so very, very tall, they would set fire to that to try to drive them out. And, or else they would just come into the home and want food or something. So I had a lot of interesting tales from her. So my grandmother and her older sister went to Concarey, New Mexico to work as young women. And my grandmother first married a gentleman whose last name was Jones. And he was very wealthy and owned a motel in Mineral Wells, a hotel, I guess one would say, at that time, in Mineral Wells, Texas. And he passed away, and my grandmother stayed there and maintained the business. My grandfather, as a young man, had rheumatoid arthritis and had gone to Mineral Wells for treatments with the hot springs they had. And everyone told him that he should meet this beautiful young woman who was running this boarding house. And that is how my grandparents wound up getting married and being in the farm where they are. Well, they didn't start out in that home. They started out, they built a home 1 mile south of the Massey family farm on the Edwards Pawnee County line. And they built a home 1 mile south of there, which caught fire and burned. Then they bought a farm south of Belfry, 4 miles south of Belfry, where they raised Thelma and my mother. So as near as I can calculate, about 1939, my grandfather bought the farm where I now live. It belonged to one of his sisters, Maud. She had married Harry Bridges. And she died in that flu pandemic of, I believe it was 1918. And Harry remarried. He had two sons by Maud. But my grandfather bought that farm, and they moved from the Belfry community to the Lewis community at about that time, what I can figure in my mind. And so then that's how Kay and I came to live in that farm place 3 miles east of Lewis.
That's a long way getting there.
Yeah, well.
Was your grandmother Harvey girl? Was that what she went to
no,
do?
She no, she wasn't. I do not know whether they had friends. I don't believe there was any relatives there. I do not know what drove, what took she and Donna there to work. They were not Harvey girls, but some way or other they wound up there. Mm-hmm. That was a part of my grandmother's life because she had married and he had died. And really, really, I was one of the few people that knew that. My grandmother did not share that information with too many people. Perhaps in that time, I don't know, you know,
well,
since he passed away, I don't know what would have been the reason not to share, but she had not. So that part of her life was, you know, why they went there, and I don't know.
Hmm. Well, that's really interesting. And it's nice that you were, that they lived long enough with the Oklahoma ones to be able to hear those stories, that they had that longevity. That's really neat. Okay, let me see here. You were 41. I don't imagine you remember too much about World War II.
Not too much. My father was in World War II, and I did not know my father. I got in touch with him and met him when I was 36 years old. And so he made the Air Force his lifelong
career,
yes. So he told me quite a few stories, but he, in World War II, he flew a bomber. He was stationed in England, and he flew out of England. And, there was quite a few stories of saying, like one can imagine, of sitting around having a quick breakfast and everybody leaving on their flight to bomb and not everyone coming back. Mm-hmm. And he was shot up many times. He lost his, when the bomb bay was hit, he lost his, some of the personnel on the plane, you know, but they managed to cripple back into base. But his bombardier was killed. And so fascinating stories that he shared. But no, and what kind of an impact did it make on the household? Being raised with my grandparents who had...
I suppose that would be the biggest impact, because your mother went to college and your dad went there. So that was a big impact that affected you the rest of your life. Because
it didn't... in rural Kansas, it didn't make that big of a difference. And I really kind of think because my grandparents had survived so many hardships and gone through the dirty 30s, that they knew how to exist. Grandma raised chickens, we had cattle, and she always canned our food. So if there was rationing or things as a child, I was unaware because we ate the same dastardly breaded tomatoes that I hated so badly.
You don't make them much anymore, do you?
Do not eat them at all.
I mean, that must have been a World War II thing. I remember eating those.
Oh, dreadful.
I love tomatoes.
Bread. Yeah. It's the slimy bread.
I love hot tomatoes, but not breaded tomatoes. Okay. So, let's see. So, where did you go to school then?
I went to school at Lewis.
At Lewis. Mm-hmm. And do you have any memories about elementary school or high school there, that what it was like?
Oh.
How many were in your class?
We had the smallest class in school. I was trying to think, you know, the enrollment at Lewis at that time must have been between 180 and 200 because we had the smallest class. There was 12 in my class. But most classes had anywhere from 15 to 20. Yes, you know, there's such a difference between now and then. We would go outside to play and you would take a stick and draw a house, you know, or build houses out of tumbleweeds, and you knew how to play, and it wasn't all organized play. We went to school from 8 to 4. The last hour of school was sports. If you were not out for sports, which they didn't have a lot for girls at that time, we had study hall, and we had the wonderful English teacher, Mrs. Garrison, who did study hall and recruited many people to learn to be librarians, so we always sat in the back room and glued and or repaired books and this kind of thing. But that's one of the major differences. Everyone rode to school on a bus. Everyone went home at 4 o'clock. We had one game, generally on a Friday, so you did not have the schedule that the kids have now. You did not. Long bus routes. I know Kay and I would get on the bus. It was dark, and we had Hugh Snowblum as a bus driver. He loved to make a little dust on the road. We traveled fast, but there was, I believe there were three major bus routes. There was ours to the north and one that was really down south, and then Devere Mead drove one that went kind of on the south and east. But lots of rural kids to pick up, a lot of family farms, lots of kids out of the country, which is different now. You didn't see so many kids have cars driving to school. We all traveled on bus. First grade teacher, Mrs. Rankin, loved to get discipline with a very sharp pencil.
Wrapping your head.
Yeah. Tapping you on the head with a pencil to get your attention. And she wanted to, which probably would be frowned upon today. Spankings were more prolific in those days, you know. You could tell when the superintendent, Mr. Johnson, when he was mad, his face got as red as a beet. And we had a one-armed superintendent, Mr. Eggleston, who demanded a lot of respect.
How would you spell Eggleston?
E-G-G-L-E-S-T-O-N, Eggleston. They, when they retired, when they fully retired, I believe they were in the Larned area. Fabulous teachers, I must say, all through the school, our high school teachers were just tremendous. Mrs. Garrison, our English teacher, was not too looked forward to by most kids to be in her class, but when they got to college, they so appreciated having had her. She was tough. Our math teacher was very gifted in math. And he had a very hard time explaining to the kids that did not understand math, about math. So even though he was excellent, he was not, you know, the best there was, because he couldn't reach the kids who couldn't understand. We just had such a great faculty. We truly did.
That's nice to hear.
Now, I will have to interject that there was a period in my time going to school. My mother remarried, and she was at Wichita State University, and she met a gentleman by the name of Robert Williams, who was head of the radio TV program at Wichita. And she married him when I was about 10. And he took a job in Birmingham, Alabama, as manager of a radio TV station, mainly TV, WSG in Birmingham, and it had a subsidiary all-black station, WBCO, in Bessemer, Alabama. So she took me to live with them for a few years, and I went to school in Birmingham, Alabama.
Oh, well, tell us about that. How is that different than Lewis, Kansas?
Oh, my goodness. You know, you're looking at in the early 50s, mm-hmm. and it was probably the loneliest stretch of my life. Plus, I was removed from my home situation and with people, but my mother had been in and out of my life all the time because this was her family's home. But I was living with she, and then I didn't know Bob Williams. And I'm backing up on a lot of things too, but an interesting thing with Mr. Williams, he wrote the Buck Rogers comic series under the pen name of Bob Barton. And every Thursday he would fly, you know, take to the airport the comic strip for the following week to Chicago and mail it to them. He was extremely intelligent, extremely intelligent. Life in Birmingham was very different. The school was old. We went it was Shades Cahaba. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the blacks is what, you know, is the biggest thing I can tell you, because, you know, water fountains were restricted for them. Their schools were just so shabby, no windows or doors, I can remember. They had no sidewalks.
Okay, your school was not integrated. It was just white.
It's just white.
And what was that, Shades?
It was Shades, and in another word, Cahaba, Chaba.
And that's the name of the school?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It was so very lonely for me in a home life, because the families of the kids that I went to school with looked upon me as a Yankee, a Northerner, for number one, from Kansas, and number two, my stepfather's affiliation with an all-black station. No kid was allowed to come to my house. There was one other girl in the school, a Jew from New York. we sort of were a duet, you know. But our home was out on Lakeshore Drive at the time, and it was kind of in a wooded area. And I did have a dog that was my best friend, a collie, because kids just weren't allowed to associate with me because of where I was from and my stepfather's affiliation with blacks. The whole thing is true about the back of the bus being the main back seat and two in front for the black people to ride on. It was phenomenal. And I will have to say, every morning we pledged the rebel flag in our classroom. We sang the Alabama State song, and we went to the auditorium and watched old reruns of Civil War movies. They just kept hounding you, you know, that the South did not lose. They just gave up. They did not lose to the North. It was like a step back in time, the way they were living, you know, such indoctrination to the kids. Just lived in the past.
Did you have any relationship with other black children, or was that not?
No, I didn't have any with any white kids either.
Just the Jews.
Except for this New York Jewish girl. It was a dreadful time. And
do you know why your father, or stepfather, was managing a black station? I mean,
it was a subsidiary. It was owned by the same corporation that had the WSGN radio TV station in Birmingham. They had a subsidiary. They owned this this station was, in Bessemer.
Was that, you probably don't know, but it'd be interesting to know whether where that ownership was out of, if it was out of, you know, like New York or something, yes, rather than the South.
That I can't answer, but I spent a tremendous amount of time at radio. I loved it. I loved it. I loved watching and listening to them, and still to this day I have contact with them, with a friend, Bob Bandy, who was an announcer on the radio and TV station. He has since passed away, but his wife, Kathleen, I call her Kat, is still living in Florida, and I still maintain communication with her. They were tremendous family friends. They really were.
Now, at that time, did entertainers come in and, you know, do interviews and things, or was it basically records? And
a little bit. They had people come in that they interviewed on the air, and, you know, yes.
Hmm.
Yes.
That's really interesting, yeah.
I love that.
So, when did you come back then to this end, and why did you come back?
The marriage failed, mm-hmm. and my mother... I came back every summer to the farm. It was so sad. I came back every summer to the farm, and at the end of my seventh grade, my mother sent me back to live. And so I came back to Lewis in the eighth grade and finished out high school with my grandparents. Now, my mother moved back to the area, and at that time, Belfry and Truesdale had consolidated, and she taught music there, Belfry Truesdale School. We are looking in the mid-50s, because at about the same time, early 50s, 52 or 53, Centerview consolidated with Lewis, and that's really how I met Dean. You know, things were different in those days. I did not know a lot of people in the Centerview area. We just didn't, you know, went to church and did your own community thing here. We had what we needed in Lewis. And so this is about the time then that Dean came up. I'm thinking around 53, 52 or 53 maybe, that Centerview came. But anyway, Belfry and Truesdale had consolidated about the same time, and my mother taught music there.
Do you remember anything about that consolidation, how the communities felt? Or
it seemed very smooth. It seemed very smooth. I do not remember any rivalries or any bad things being said. You know, they were welcomed in, and I never gathered that from Dean or his younger brother, Keith, that there was ever any problems with having to come to Lewis.
The Centerview probably had gotten quite small by this time.
Yes, I think it had.
And maybe the kids were happy to have more kids.
Yes, you know, I think Dean's father, Harold, I believe there was just two people in his class. But, I mean, you're looking back quite a ways. Mm-hmm. It was interesting. It really was. And so then I finished out my high school years.
And what was, in high school, let's see, did you have any job as a teenager, or chores at home, or, you know, what was
a little bit of everything. I think, I don't know whether I would have been this way had I lived with my mother and father, but having been raised with my grandparents, I was in with older generation people, and it just seemed that I was always old for my age. You know, when I host my class now, when we get together for reunions and I have them come back, I listened to the tales that they did, and I did not participate. So to answer your question, it seemed like my better friends were my teachers. I babysat for my teachers. If they had a problem within the structure of the class, quite frequently they would ask me, you know, what my opinion was on this. So it just seemed like I was just always old. Born old.
Well, just the experience going to Alabama would have aged you.
Well, and you know, being raised in a generation mm-hmm. above where you would have been, mm-hmm. the people that I grew up knowing were my grandparents' mm-hmm. friends. Mm-hmm. My grandfather's family settled, were mostly all around here, and so his brothers and sisters, though they were my great-aunts and uncles, I just called them mm-hmm. aunt and uncle, because, you know, that's just the way it was. So I was just always around older people.
So you met Dean then. Did you start dating in high school? Or?
Yes. Dean graduated 2 years prior. But about the time that he was a senior in 57, we started dating, and then he went to Southwestern.
Well, what was dating like in Lewis? What did you do for entertainment?
we did have drive-ins. We did have a drive-in movie that was one at Larned. And maybe we went to a movie once a week, perhaps. But quite often, you know, he had work to do too, and we just didn't date an awful lot. But in the summer, if he was in the field or whatever, he would just come up to the house and we would watch TV with Grandma and Grandpa.
When did you get your TV?
Oh, goodness. It must have been around 55 or 56, somewhere in that vicinity. Mm-hmm. Seems like we had TV.
With one station, or?
Maybe three at the most. There wasn't a lot. Brings back a funny story in my mind. My grandmother was in Oklahoma visiting with her sisters and seeing her parents, and it was school time, so I was home, and Dean was up, and we were sitting in the living room of the house where I am now, and Grandpa was in his usual rocker. And the TV was, you know, it was not coming in very well. And Grandpa said, I'm going to go get the shotgun and go outside and shoot, because there's birds on the antenna, and it was making a lot of snow on the screen, see? So Dean and I were sitting there, and we heard this loud explosion in the kitchen. You know, your heart is here, and you're thinking, what in the world? And I heard Grandpa laugh, you know, so Dean and I went into the kitchen, and my granddad had his work boots on, and he'd put the barrel of the shotgun just here on the rim of the sole of his shoe and pulled it back to load it. And he still had arthritis. He was in his, it had to have been in his 70s at that time. So when he brought the stock up like this, he pulled the trigger, and it shot a small little bore down through the kitchen floor, but you know what the shot did downstairs with all of Grandma's canned goods. I heard Grandpa laugh, so Dean and I went out there, and he looked up and he said, won't Mom snort when she sees this? I tell you, we had that hole patched and the mess cleaned up in the basement before Grandpa got home. But the birds left.
You didn't need TV, though. You had work to do.
Nothing like a shotgun in the house to get your attention.
And this house that you were growing up in, we didn't ask this earlier, but did it always have electricity while you were there?
Yes.
And indoor plumbing and water? And
yes, I was very fortunate in that respect, except when the power went off. Mm-hmm. The house was all electrical. We had a wash house to the north of the main house, and it had a cob-burning stove, you know, a coal-lit cob, that we used when the lights went off. We had to dig through the snow to get to it. But as near as I can hear, even when my grandparents had their home south of Belbury, they had a Delco plant down in the basement. I still have a big glass container like this that I subsequently learned was...
That was about 15 inches.
Yeah. It housed the batteries for the Delco plants. And I have seashells in it. Interesting. Mm-hmm. But that was, you know, I don't remember that. But yes, I always had electricity.
Okay, so we have you dating in high school, and then you were going to talk about Dean going to Southwestern, did you say?
He went to Southwestern to study. He thought he wanted to be a minister. He studied for 2 years down there, and during that time then, when I graduated, I went to K-State, and he transferred up to K-State then, and found that he really was interested in education, so he got his degree in math. He is a math teacher.
And so you were writing and corresponding while you were at different colleges. Did you know that early that you were going to get married? Did you?
Oh, you know, probably so. You know, I had never dated much. Dean probably had more than I. But once we started dating, you know, we just stayed as a couple for several years. I went down another little, I'm trying to think what year that was. I went down to Southwestern for, you know, a lot of their activities and homecoming and this type of thing. And it was a beautiful campus, but Dean and I always knew.
And was Dean a Methodist and you were a Methodist? Because Southwestern is a Methodist school. I mean, yes. Just trying to think, at that time, were you going to church at the Methodist? Or?
Well, see, they had the little church down in Centerview that has since been moved up here. Mm-hmm. And I think it was more affiliated with Friends, that little church was down there.
That could be.
I think it was. I think it was a Methodist church, but then... And so many of Dean's, of the Newsoms and Dean's relatives were there. Most of his cousins, you know, went there. Some of his family that came up from Centerview went to the Christian church, like Aunt Bernice. And some of the Dean's parents went to the Methodist church. But I believe it had a little bit of Friends background because, you know, the way I went to church with Dean several times down there and the way the service went, it wasn't. But yes, we were always Methodists. And when he taught at Riley County, we went to the Methodist Church in the little town of Riley. So, yeah.
What was the Methodist Church in Lewis like in the 50s?
We had, it was an older church. Let me say this, because I know that our youth group met in the Christian church at that time because there were more youth that were involved in the Christian church. So we would meet on Sunday nights, the young people would, at the Christian church. And Wayne and Esther Bell, the Monique's parents, were in charge of the youth group at that time. So it was just a, you know, we had a lot of people in the church, but they were mostly all older than it seemed like. We had a lot of youth.
Maybe that's something that, you know, me coming into that community, the churches seemed to cooperate, and what that sounds like they were cooperating back then too. Is that sort of the tradition in Lewis that churches have done that, or not always?
To a certain degree, but you know, when it came to a point where they talked of maybe unitizing and just having one church, that did not happen.
But they did talk about that at one time.
At one time, I think many years ago, that had been when the Methodist Church was getting into rack and ruin, you know, crumbling away. They had talked about that. There was talk about it. But we even have, was that that little Assembly of God? Was that what that was?
I think maybe somebody else mentioned an Assembly of God.
Yes, over there by where the Fankhausers live, close to the high school, close to the school. There's a small little church building. The Hecocks went to it. And I think it got down to such few membership finally. And we had a large Baptist church because of the Wheaton families, and a lot of them were on the school board. But at that time, yes, the youth group met in the Christian church.
And there wasn't a Catholic church?
Not in Lewis.
Were there many Catholics that lived there?
The Snoblin family. The main Snoblin family, Hugh and Eileen, and all of that family.
Would they have come into Kinsley?
Say they came to Kinsley. If I want to remember right, I believe they came to Kinsley to church because their Uncle Reen, Buzz's husband, I believe they came over here to church. It got to be a time, you know, when a lot of Catholics in our area went over to Belfry too. Such a church.
I think we learned Castaneda's came over here.
Uh-huh. But I believe the Snoblin family did. And I'm trying to think. Yeah, we had the Castaneda's in our community. You know, we always had such good families, the Martinez's. You know, they worked for the railroad, and they lived in the little yellow houses on the north side of the railroad that were supplied for railroad workers to live in. So we did have a lot of Mexican families in Lewis when we were growing up.
Did you have any Hispanics in your class in school, or?
I didn't, but there were a lot of Castanedas in the school. There were good families, fabulous athletes. Yeah, Pete and Frank, Nick.
And And from your viewpoint, were they well integrated into the community?
Absolutely.
Or did you see prejudice? Or?
None whatsoever. I never felt that. They were just part of the community. Mm-hmm. Always. You know? I never felt that.
I guess that there were no blacks in Lewis.
I can't remember any. No.
That must have been, I can't get over you living in Alabama. That must have been quite a change.
Yes, it was. It truly was. In every facet, you know, of the home life, you know, where you really didn't know my mom or my stepdad at all. And having such biased opinions, you know.
And your mother and stepdad would have been liberals or considered, right?
Yes. My mother worked as a secretary for a dinner club called B Club. It was up on top of the mountain. WSGN radio station was about halfway up, and then my mother worked all the way up to the top at a club. And, you know. And jumping back to those days, another interesting point about it was Birmingham was such a steel manufacturing city that at that point in time in history, the big concern was if the United States was attacked, that would be one place that would be hit. And as students, we had to wear dog tags.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, that was wonderful because the kids have all these little love affairs, you know, and everybody was switching dog tags. Nobody kept their own.
And this was, but this is in this is the Korean War era rather than World
50s.
War II. So they're still worried during the Korean about an attack like it had happened.
Mm-hmm. And instead of having, you know, in case of tornado alerts, you mm-hmm. know, how they have the kids at school here. We were trained for bombs, you mm-hmm. know, how we were to crouch down in the hall and cover our heads, but we all had to wear these dog tags. And I have thought of that. It is so ironic. Nobody would know who was missing because nobody had their own dog tag. If you had a little boyfriend or whatever mm-hmm. at the time, everybody switched dog tags. But yes, we had to wear dog tags for identification in case of the city being bombed.
Well, that's an interesting, yeah. We didn't really ask if the Korean War affected you at all. Or
so. Not knowing, you know, that, but that's the only way it was.
Yeah, yeah.
You know. Oh, let's see, what else?
Well, let's see, where. So you went to K-State, you became engaged sometime.
Yes, yes. Not at first, you know, when I went to K-State, not at first. But I studied law for 3 years at K-State.
Oh.
And then about that time when Dean and I decided that we probably would get married, and we looked at the situation, you know, how would law be that good for me, I changed to the field of education primarily because it was the department that would take all of my crazy hours of law, from criminology to German to everything, without me losing a lot of hours. So I went into special education.
Jeez, I think the community could have used another lawyer.
Yeah.
You should have stayed.
Yes, I have sometimes questioned that decision, you know, after having 3 years in it, why I didn't pursue it.
Were there many women in law school at that time?
No, not many. Of course, this was preliminary law, you
mm-hmm,
know.
Pre-law.
Yes. It was all pre-law. But
and you were thinking
many.
About being a lawyer, not a legal secretary.
Right.
At that
I was
time.
Thinking about being a lawyer. I had not decided if I wanted to be corporate law or family law, but I had always thought that that would be fun. Love to mix things up, I guess. But
your grandparents were funding your college, or?
That and scholarships.
And scholarships.
And,
did you work?
Lived in the dorm, and you worked, you know, and Dean worked, and so then we got married in 61, and I still had college to finish, and that was Dean's senior year, and he worked at several jobs, you know. We had a little.
Did you go to married housing then, or a
no?
Apartment?
We lived in a little apartment on Points,
on Point
Main Street there, and Then when he graduated, he started looking for jobs, and there was one in Green Bay, Wisconsin that I thought would really be fun, because I thought, wow. But he wound up taking a job at a consolidated high school, at Riley County High School. It was a consolidation between Keats, which is outside of Manhattan, and then Leonardville, and then Riley. And the school had been placed between the two little towns of Riley and Leonardville, which did cause a lot of problems with the people up here in Keats. You know, it was a lot of busing problems. But when Dean went to work there, it was its second year that it had been built. He taught math there and coached.
You were still, had another year of college?
I was still going to college. We rented. Well, first of all, when we were first married, we rented a house in Leonardville. It was a three-story home, and the football coach lived in the basement, and Dean and I lived on the main floor, and a single elementary teacher lived upstairs. Hmm. And we lived there, and our first son, Derek, was born when we lived there in 63. And then we rented a little house then over in the little town of Riley about in 65 and moved there. And ultimately we built a home in Riley then in 67 and lived there. It was wonderful years. Mm-hmm. Wonderful years. All the kids were born in that area, and oh, we still have such tremendous friends from that time.
And so it was really education that took you out of Edwards County.
Yes, it was.
And then did not come back right away.
We didn't come back. We came back every summer to farm. Mm-hmm. Dean was farming for his father. And then in 75, Dean's father wanted to go into irrigation. And there wasn't any way really feasibly that we could be 200 miles away from the fields and irrigate. So Dean had to decide to either stay in the teaching field or to come back to the farm. And so he left teaching and we moved back to the farm in 75.
What went into making that decision? Why did he?
The love of farming. Mm-hmm. He loved to do it. And he just couldn't bring himself around to saying, okay, you know, I won't go back and do any more farming. We'll just have to get someone else to farm the land. Because irrigation, you needed to be on top of it, and the school season didn't allow that. So we came back.
So your father-in-law did not start irrigating until 1975,
right,
about. He had
right.
not irrigated prior to
no,
that.
He okay. had been dry land farming prior to that time.
Okay, so continue.
So we came back, and when my grandmother had passed away, she had left me the farmhouse out here, and so we fixed it up. It had been broken into so many times. But you know, even though we came back every summer and boarded it up and stayed there, it just was sitting idle. And so that brought us back to the farm, and we added on to it and fixed it up, changed it around a little bit for our family to grow up there. Boys all went to school at Lewis, graduated from Lewis.
Okay, let's see. All right, now, I don't know if you can help us by agricultural changes and things.
I might interject one other little thing that might be of interest. When I was, I'm jumping back now to when Dean was going to Southwestern, mm-hmm. and as a senior, I went down for homecoming, and I was staying with Beverly Clutter in the dorms for homecoming, and Beverly and her boyfriend and Dean and I were in church the Sunday morning that they came to her about her family having been killed.
Oh, my word.
Just a little piece of history where
you were in church and they came to the church to tell her
to get Beverly in her to get Beverly out of church. Her older sister lived in Kansas City,
but and that's what
we
spared her when we read mm-hmm. In Cold Blood. Mm-hmm. You know, we knew she was
mm-hmm.
not home.
She was there. we were together in church, you know, the four of us, when they came to get her out of church. So. It's funny how historical things sometimes touch you, you know.
And did you know her? Or
having been down before, you know, yes. Not well, yeah. But yes, I knew her, you know, and that's how I wound up staying with her when I went down to stay for the weekend.
My goodness.
So let me see, agricultural changes.
Well, yeah, if we're talking about like when you were in high school or whatever, and I don't know what farm I'm on here to talk to you, but did they pretty much do their own farming? Did they have hired help?
Yes, my granddad did most of his farming, however, and I can't tell you his last name, we had, on the farm where I live, we had a little bunkhouse, it was called, just across the driveway. We tore it down when Dean and I moved back. We started, you know, the boys and he tore down several old buildings. But there was a gentleman by the name of Hugh, I do not know his last name. He came every summer and stayed in that little bunkhouse and helped my grandfather and his older brother Floyd, who farmed 4 miles north of us on the family farm. But
your grandmother never worked. She
cooked.
Yeah.
Oh, she cooked.
We shouldn't use the term work.
Yeah. Lots of hard
outside
work
outside the home.
I know.
And you have already told her she canned and
yes.
Put up most of your food and that sort of thing.
I remember my grandmother telling when she and my grandfather were first married, and they lived on the family farm up on the county line until they built their home. In those days, they had threshing crews that came around to do the wheat. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother spoke about the monstrous amount of cooking that she had to do. How many loaves of bread they made every morning, and they just set up tables out in the yard, you know, for the crew to eat, and they slept in the barn, and so she talked about how much work that was to do their laundry and to feed.
You were around, the mechanization had made it possible.
Absolutely.
Not to have
you
all
had
the
combines.
Threshing.
You did not have threshing crews. Mm-hmm. We had combines, small, but combines.
Did you have chores during harvest?
Yes, I did, driving the truck.
And you took the grain to Lewis?
Well,
no?
Some, but the combines were so very small then that when we were cutting wheat down on the farm south of Belfry, we would go over and stay in the house over there. It was a beautiful home down there. 2 weeks it would take us to cut. So, you know, just help.
Did you take the grain to Belfry then?
Yes, mm-hmm. Yes. Belfry then. And then when I got old enough, I drove the tractors for Grandpa, and we didn't have cabs. We were out in the elements, no cabs on tractors, and no cabs on combines, and lots of hard work. And
how did you like that?
I guess it was fun, you know. Grandpa would set me out in the field to work, and he'd say, just pick a point, you know, straight across and drive for it. Try to drive as straight as you can.
Mm-hmm.
I drove tractor for him a lot. He had a small amount of cattle, and I helped him with that. Seemed like they always had calves in the dead of winter, and I would take a sled, and he and I would go out there and load the baby on the sled, and I'd help pull it back to the barn. Had horses to ride. My grandpa had to ride horses as a kid, and he never could understand who in their right mind would ever want a horse just to ride for no reason. He said, if you ever had to sit on one all day for days on end. But he made sure that Kay and I had a pinto mare that we rode as a kid.
Did anybody help besides your grandfather and you? Were there relatives or anybody came in, or just the two?
No, just this Hugh that came up.
And him.
Uh-huh. Came up in the summer times, and I don't remember anybody else.
Well, I'm trying to think, and you told me this one time, but your cousin that
yes,
was living,
cousin Kay.
Good. Where was she at this time?
Well, you know, it was hard for me to kind of understand at the time as being a kid, and it has no negativity toward my grandmother. She was such a loving person. But when my grandparents, my grandmother was 55 and my grandpa was 62, when they got K&I, my grandmother was so full of grief with Aunt Thelma having been killed in such a horrific crash that she just took Kay and just kind of suffocated her, you know, just took her under her wing. Not to say that she didn't pay attention to me, but I was with my grandpa. My grandpa took me in the pickup. When I had earaches, he would hold me on his lap and blow the smoke from his pipe into my ears. You know, he took care of me a lot. And you know, that's hard to say without making it look like Grandma was indifferent, but she wasn't indifferent to me. She just, I understood it when I got older. She just suffocated Kay. Kay had hay fever quite bad. So she could not be out in the elements, you know. She couldn't go out in the pickup and help with this and that. And so Kay was just kind of mothered and kept in the house and had a little different lifestyle than I did.
Well, you had more of the role of a boy.
Absolutely.
And she maybe did. She probably helped with the cooking and the housework.
Yes, you know, much to her dislike. Kay could run like the wind. She was a tremendous athlete. It's too bad we didn't have good sports when, you know, when she was young, because she was a good athlete. Huh. She was.
Did your grandfather use, do you remember using fertilizers, pesticides, or
we didn't
was that
use
later?
So much in those days. You know, you allowed more Mother Nature to take its course as to what your yield was going to be. And we did not, I say we did not have the corn that you see now, certainly not the beans, but yet when I get to talking with older farmers, they did have a special glove and kind of a hook that they used when they went out to cut corn in the field. But our main crops were just wheat and milo. That's what the country was designed for at that time.
Do you remember the yield at all for wheat when you were dry laying?
Goodness, you know, it could be anywhere probably from 5 to 25. I mean, you didn't have these hellacious kind of yields that we have now, because you pump on water and all of the other nutrients and the pesticides. We just didn't have it, you know. So we didn't. I often think how my granddad would view the cost of machinery now. And I mean, you can get into the cab of a tractor or combine and put on your GPS system and sit back and watch a movie in the cab while it drives for you. It would be quite a shock, and the cost of things would be phenomenal, because my granddad, I'm sure, was not any different from most people of that generation. If they did not have the money to pay for it, they didn't buy it. So you would have to have quite a fortune now to pay for these $140,000 pieces of equipment on up.
Okay, so Dean came back and he ended up with his father's farm?
And
your farm. Grandparents' farm.
Yes.
Right. So you inherited all, sort of?
No, not really. I mean, we rented.
You rented.
We rented it. Kay and my mother inherited my family's land, Kay coming in because her mother had passed away. And Dean's parents were still alive and they owned their land. And so, and we rented land from Aunt Bernice and Uncle Merle. And subsequently through the years, as the years passed by, Harold's cousin, Ralph Newsom, we farmed for Ralph Newsom and for Lee Newsom, a lot of that older generation. We rented their land, farmed a lot of dry land. Kept us very busy with four sons. Our sons can attest, you know, their dad loved to wake the birds up in the morning 5:30 with the start of the tractors in the fields and work until it was dark. They put in long hours because we had a lot of dry land to farm at that time.
And
that was before the CRP programs came in.
Okay, and you told us ahead of time, but maybe we ought to go through. Your oldest son, Derek, was born in 63,
mm-hmm.
and Darren in 65, and David in 67,
mm-hmm.
and Daniel in 73.
Right.
And are any of them farmers?
Derek.
Derek.
The older son loves to farm. They all farmed. They all worked hard on the farm. Our third son, David, was a writer, and he's an English teacher now, you know, and to him it was the most worthless amount of time going from one end of a field to another all day long. He would never have returned to the farm. Mm-hmm. But he did it. Mm-hmm. But it was not his forte in life. He loves what he does. He teaches English in a school outside of Chicago, and he loves it.
And Darren?
Darren enjoyed farming. He wound up doing what he loves to do, too. He's a chief grain merchandiser for DTN, which is a data networking system for farmers. It's based in Omaha, Nebraska, and he's their chief grain analyst.
So I'm guessing he maybe went to K-State or...
No, he went to Hayes.
Mm-hmm. But he's in agriculture, but not in the production
That's
of it.
Right.
And David?
David is the third son, who's an English teacher.
Oh, he's the English teacher. Uh-huh. Daniel.
Daniel was in landscape design. He went to K-State and was in landscape design for years. Loved it. Absolutely loved it. Very, very hard work. When he married, he stayed in landscape design for a while, but he married an only child of a gentleman who was in the computer business, and they sold huge risograph copy machines that hospitals and churches and schools used because it made such a large amount of copies in a short amount of time. And so my daughter-in-law's father, Ken, persuaded Dan to come to work for him, you know. And so he's in the computer business, but he still loves and would someday hope to just, you know, maybe on the weekends do landscape design. The farmer in him still likes to do that.
And what land does Derek farm?
Derek farms all of the land that Dean and I had, but so much of Ralph Newsom's and Lee Newsom's land is in the CRP program. So many people went into that. But, you know, you're just kind of a overseer of that land. You just maintain it. But he farms our land, and that's about it. That keeps him busy.
Well, the reason I went through that was just to show the, you know, the change, how Dean went away but then came back.
Yes.
And then out of four children, only one is here. And
Derek did go away for a bit. He went to Dallas and worked. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the draw of the farm brought him back. I think our younger son, Dan, could probably have been drawn back to the farm. Out of all of the boys, David would be the one that absolutely would not have come back. But Darren loved statistics in college. He loved statistics, and so he really, really, really enjoyed. The only thing he didn't like was when he was handling other people's money, you know, and if it rained in Spain and the price ran down, you hate to lose money for people. But he loves what he's doing.
Do you think you have any prospects of your grandchildren wanting to farm?
I can see Derek's children because they are the most involved in it. You know, the other kids live in Omaha and Kansas City. And our third son, David, he and his wife adopted two little girls from China, so there's no prospects there. But Derek's two older boys are learning to drive equipment, and they may. I'm not, you know, it's hard to say.
It's hard to say, yeah.
It's hard to say.
When Dean came back and started farming with his father, did his father retire at one point? And
shortly after we came back, we bought out his equipment, Harold's equipment, and Dean just took over. Harold was ready for that. Dean's parents, his mother was a registered nurse, and she'd worked with Dr. Snowblin in the hospital for years and years, and at that time was one of the charge nurses at the Larned State Hospital. And when farming was just really tough, Harold went up there and worked also on the Dillon building. So, you know, they both drove, and Aunt Bernice worked up there. All three of them drove to Larned and worked. to augment
Dillon
the farm.
Dillon Building, what's that?
That was the hardened criminals.
Okay.
That was the ones that had committed murder, really.
Now, we had somebody else tell us that that was a job for farmers after they retired and things to go to Larned. And
absolutely.
And
you know, to help augment the salary for the farm. I mean, Harold was still farming at that time, though Dean was coming back every summer and helping. Then when we moved out in 75, he just, you know, took over. We just rented the land from his father then. And then Harold didn't work much longer up at Larned State.
That's interesting. That's one thing I've learned from the interviews already that I didn't know beforehand about the
several
the opportunity for employment up there helped the farmers, you know, get by. And
another I don't know how many interesting stories
we
you
like
want.
Interesting stories.
But it would have been I'm trying to think. There was a man by the name of Carl McKittrick that killed Ed Sparks' girl out on the streets of Dodge City. They had been dating and she wanted to break it off with him, and downtown, many people watching, he stabbed her more than 20-25 times, killed her. He was a patient at Larned State Hospital under the care of my mother-in-law, June. Whoever decided he was rehabilitated decided, and he was set free. And I encountered him many times. He worked when DERS had implement repair places. You could, a department, you could go in there and get, Dean would send me on runs to get repairs. And he would be working there. You would see him around Larned. I think if you'd never even known that he had murdered someone, he was still kind of a creepy person. So let's fast forward to about 9 years ago when Dean's mother had colon cancer surgery and she was in the hospital at Great Bend. When they sent her up on fifth floor for rehab, I went up on a Saturday morning to visit with her and be there for a while. And when the shift change came on, I looked out to the desk and who was coming on duty but Carl McKittrick as a charge nurse. And I tell myself, what is going to happen when he walks into this room? Well, he came in, you know, did her vitals, and I could see by her eyes. And when he left, she said, "Donna, is that who I think that is?" And I said, "Yes." She was petrified. She said, "He knows who I am. He's in charge of my meds. He's in charge of everything." I stayed with her until he went off duty at 11 o'clock that night or whatever. There was no way to get a hold of the DON that weekend. But when I called to say, you know, how can this even be possible? Do you know his history? And was told that, you know, he'd been rehabilitated. I said, by whose standards? And I said, do you realize how many people this affects in this community? Because I have since learned that other people like Esther Bell and other people have been in that hospital who knew this gentleman, and they were just petrified. My mother-in-law was scared to death, you know. So you can't help but, and I still see him to this day. I sing with a group in Larned, and he comes and is in the audience when we sing. And your mind says, you know, how? He cold-bloodedly killed this young, beautiful girl. And how is he justified to be out in this community and participate, you know? So those are the things that come along in your life that make you just wonder how it can be. But yes, that was in the Sentinel not too many months ago. They were looking back and they reviewed situation of Louise Farm having been killed. And there he is, enjoying love. So, let's see. Back on track now. I keep jumping off the track.
No, we're doing really good. I'm looking at my questions, and we've covered an awfully lot of it. I'm trying to think.
Another facet I could jump back to, having, like I said, my great aunts and uncles be my aunts and uncles. And I wish... There was a time then that I wish they had been of aunts and uncles' age so that I could have acquired the knowledge that I wish I had now that I didn't know at the time. But my Uncle Rudy, he was married to my granddad's sister, Pearl. He and my granddad's sister May's husband, Homer Polson. They lived in Garfield, and they had Uncle Rudy had the bank in Garfield, Rudy Sleepig, and he rode the orphan train.
How do you spell that last name?
He rode the orphan train, S-L-E-P-A-K-E, okay. Rudolph Sleepig, S-L-E-P-A-K-E. He rode the orphan train out and from New York. And obviously, you know, when he got off on the platform at the railroad station in Garfield, some family, Sleepake was not their name. That must have been his family name, and they maintained it. I wish that I had known to gather some information mm-hmm. from him. His two daughters I have written to, once in Texas and once married to a heart surgeon back east. They don't even have a lot of knowledge about it, but how fascinating it would have been to have been able to visit with Uncle Rudy.
What year do you think that would have been about when he came out?
Oh my goodness. When could that have been? My granddad was, the entire family was already here, living on the family farm. There was like 10 in the Massey family. Oh my. My grandma, what would it have been? In the before 1920 maybe? Mm-hmm. Somewhere in there, because my mother was born in 24 and Aunt Thelma would have been born 8 years before that. It would have been before 1920. It had to have been. Had to have been, because he and Aunt Pearl would have been married. Had to have been in, you know, 1912, 13, 14, somewhere near. I don't know.
That right?
You know, I don't know when he arrived here. I'm trying to think of when he and Aunt Pearl would have even, you know, gotten married. So in the early 1900s, he had to have been sent out as a child on the orphan train. One would think. I would think so. Because he'd be well over 100 years old. Mm-hmm. Rudy would now. So it had to have been in the early 1900s.
You just never know, do you?
Fascinating. Just yeah. Fascinating. And I
suppose he never talked about it or kept records or...
Obviously not, because his daughters don't know much about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's what, you know, I thought, surely, if I got in touch with Connie and Janet, you know, I could learn something. But he had to have come out in the early 1900s, Joan.
No, early 1900s.
He had to have, as a child, mm-hmm. because I'm trying to think when he and Aunt Pearl would have been married, would have had to have been, you know, prior to 1920, I would think.
Is there anything in the Garfield book, Garfield history book, that tells anything about it? Or have you ever...
I've not been able to find anything,
okay.
And I would have thought that his daughters
would have, done that. Okay.
Would have known.
I was trying to remember. We found a few articles about the orphan train coming from the papers, and I don't even remember what dates those were.
They were. That was
early. That's what I thought.
That was in the 1890s. And
like I said, it had to be early 1900s. Had to be early. You know, they had daughters. Uncle Rudy and Aunt Pearl had two daughters. So they didn't have sons, but you know, I've contacted, because Connie and Janet were about Kay and I's age, and I have written them, and they have sent me what all they have. So obviously he did not speak much about it.
Now you might try, there's a orphan train museum in
Nebraska.
I thought it was Kansas. Is it Nebraska?
Well, there may be more than one. I know there's one in Nebraska. But it seems like it's at Atchison.
Atchison, Kansas?
Oh, just type in Orphan Train Museum.
Okay. And the woman who wrote the book. Mm-hmm. Is it, you know,
but I've been to the one in Nebraska. And there, you know, there isn't much, but it tells some of the story.
It is fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
And people just didn't garner this information.
Oh.
Just jumping aside on another track yet, when I had Dean at St. John for those 2 years, what a wealth of information there was mm-hmm. there. Just down the hall from Dean was an elderly lady by the name of Opal Moody, who I know was probably one of the last Harvey girls. And she was very deaf, but I would go down and I would say that, did anybody ever copy down anything that this woman has to say?
Well, see, that's why we're doing you today, before we get to the nursing home.
So I would go down and try to talk to her, and she had been stationed in New Mexico and hated every moment of it. Mm-hmm. But, you know, you had to shout and yell. Mm-hmm. But I could get Opal to tell me a little bit about it, and I thought, here it is, all of this history.
Well, knowing his name and things, I was just thinking if there are records of the names of the children who came out, you know, in one of these, because they've done so much research, I would say, in the last, you know, 15 years, that there might be something.
I would like to know just the name of the family who took him.
And you don't even know that?
I don't know that. Hmm. No, because I didn't know him until he had married my Aunt Pearl.
I wonder if in some of the old church records, if you could figure it out.
It would be the Methodist church there.
And see when he started going to church, and maybe you could connect in there. And whether he was baptized or not, you know, that might have been something people would have thought about not knowing, you know. I don't know. I'm just throwing that out.
And I want to interject another thing. I'm always interjecting things. But the Massey family had all of those children living up there in that big house on the county line. And they were rather affluent. They had acquired a considerable amount of land. And it was important to my great-grandparent Masseys that their children all be taught music, and so they hired a gentleman to come out, horse and wagon, from Larned, and he stayed one day and all night and the next day and gave the kids music lessons. My granddad's oldest brother, the oldest one in the family, was the organist for the Methodist Church in Garfield for 30-some years. My granddad could play the piano. The girls sang. Most of them played the piano or the organ. The youngest brother, my Uncle Harry, who married a lady at Belpre, and they lived at Belpre, and he went to the Belpre Methodist Church, played cello and sang in church all the time. I thought it was fascinating that all of these 9, 10 kids were trained musically in that day and age.
And they had a piano in the home.
They had a piano in the home. Mm-hmm. They had a piano in the home. We always had piano in the home. Still got the one that I grew up with in my home today. And so, you know, my mother's love of music, she was a music teacher and then later on got her doctorate in special education. Music has just been an integral part. And Dean's family, those four kids, Dean and his one sister and two brothers, stood beside the piano as soon as they could stand while their mother played and they sang. But to me, that was amazing. I mean, I can still hear, because for the first part of my life, my grandmother had such a hard time giving up the community of Belpre. We went to the Methodist Church in Belpre when I was very, very young, until I started school and my friends were at Lewis, and we went over to Lewis.
So in the 50s, when you were, you know, still in the home there, did you gather around the piano and sing? Was that part of the entertainment or not?
Yes, yes. But more so, I think, in Dean's home than mine. Mm-hmm. My grandmother did not play the piano as well as my mother was. Absolutely, she could play anything. If you ask her, she could play anything by ear. Mm-hmm. She was fabulous. I've always sung. I've been told when I was a little bitty, standing by my grandmother in the Methodist Church at Belpre, the preacher was Pastor Brooks. I would just sing and sing and sing and sing and sing.
And still singing today.
Still singing today. Dean and I sang an awful lot in our lives together, and our sons. Music has just been a great part of our life. And I look back to, you know, the forethought of my great-grandparent Massey's insisting.
What were your great-grandparents' names? We didn't get that because that's not normally.
I've got to stop and think. Granddad's mother's name was Susan. What was it? I know his father's name so well because I've looked it up. I'll have to.
I thought that might be interesting.
They died very young. My granddad's father died of pernicious anemia. Mm-hmm. In those days. They couldn't do too much about it. But they had moved off the farm and moved into as you're going up the Garfield Road, the farm where Matt Hall lives in now, just right before you go over the railroad tracks, was where my great-grandparents moved. They moved in.
So what was Belpre? Let's start with Belpre and then through Lewis. What was Belpre like in the 50s? Or, do you remember much?
Not too much of Belpre in the 50s, because, see, I was in the 40s when
okay,
I
well,
was
what
going
was it like
to
in
church
the
40s? Over there. I just knew it mostly from the church, because we were living where we were.
And there was a Methodist church? Or were there other churches here?
Oh, goodness, yes, there was a Catholic church and a big Baptist church. Yes, there was that gorgeous Catholic church. A lot of the, again, a lot of the people I knew from Belpre were my grandparents' age. But I grew up, you know, knowing there was another family of Breitenbaughs that were Methodist, the Roy and Esther Breitenbaugh, that were not related to the Catholic Breitenbaughs. But I knew all of the Breitenbaughs and Seti, the Seti family over there.
And there was a grocery store and...
There was a post office and... Yes... But I do remember most about Lewis. Lewis, the two blocks in Lewis. When I was growing up, you know, we had a Ford dealership. Ralph Baird and Hugh Snowden had a Ford dealership. Wayne Carney had a garage over here. We had a little cafe where ultimately Nick Castaneda had a pub. But at that time, it was the B and... Betty and what was her husband's name? Anyway, there was a little cafe here. We had Brumfield's grocery store. We had the Lewis Press. We had a drugstore. We had the post office was on the corner for a long time. It's since been torn down on the north side of what's the pub now. It was a rounded building and it used to be a post office. The bank was across the street over here, you know, where's the senior center now. We had Mabel Metling did laundry in a little gray building across here. We had Hiram Butler was a lawyer. We had Dr. McFessel on the east side of the street. Dr. McFessel had an office. His house was where the Grubers live now. Dr. Crawford was a dentist. He lived on the street going to the high school. So we had a dentist. We had Carney's had a jewelry store there. That would have been Kay Carney's husband's, Wayne Carney's family, June McLaren. So there was Carney's jewelry store on the east side. And again, this would be north of the old grocery store. So we had Carney jewelry store. We had Dr. McFessel's office. And we had a bank. And then we had Brumfield's. Pop Barnes had the big drugstore across the street. I know they had a hardware store there. Give me a minute and I'll think of their names. But there was, in two blocks, there was a lot of businesses in Lewis. There really was.
And did you go to town on Saturdays? Was that the... or?
Yes, Kay and I. Now, this was the generation where it was the good thing to go skating. And the Feldman brothers, Chet and Marvin Feldman, had a skating rink over here in Kinsley, close out here toward the BFWs. So, and Kay and I went skating every Saturday night. We had little felt skating skirts, and I still to this day have my roller skates, shoe skates. Mm-hmm. But that was our entertainment. Mm-hmm. Great fun. Good fun.
Did
good
you come over to the movies or not?
Did go to the movies as often as went skating. That was just our Saturday night thing. Grandpa would come drag us over here and sit and watch us skate round and round and round. But you know, it was wonderful fun. And I'm going to have to throw in another little story here.
Good.
With my skates. Because when Dean was in the care facility over at St. John, there was an east wing on the facility that they weren't using anymore. It was just mostly for storage. It had a long hall. And so I would get Dean down, and I visited with a lot of the residents, and I would stay quite late sometimes. And so, and this was not without permission, but I hauled my skates over there, and I would skate up and down in that vacated hall, you know, just to practice a lot with my skates. I thought it'd be fun. They're semi-precision wheels, so you can't use them on concrete, so I had to have a floor to use it. So I carried those skates in the trunk of my car, and I never will forget the first time I took my car into the co-op at Lewis to have it serviced, and they popped the trunk open so they could release the airbag. Keith Smith said, "I've never seen skates like this. What kind of skates are these? These are hectic skates. They made so much fun of my skates."
Well, I know what kind of skates you're talking about.
Yeah. Shoe skates.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. But that was our activity. I remember skating far more than I do movies. Now, Dean and I, like I said, we went to movies when we started dating. But my cousin Kay met and married her first husband. He was a Feldman. His father was a brother to the Feldman. His father was Earl Feldman. And Kay married, his name was Meredith, but we called him Bud. Kay married Bud Feldman, and they skated beautifully as a pair. So, anyway, that was the main entertainment for me.
Do you have some questions for us? We've covered a lot of ground. Like you said, it just sort of went along. That's where I'm thinking. You got to wrap this up. We've got a couple of things left to do. Okay, those concluding thoughts were highlights of your life for the last 40 years. And you've done a few of those, but were your children involved in 4-H? And then you're singing?
I was involved in Dean's singing in here. I was involved in 4-H. My children were not involved in 4-H.
Okay, you were involved in 4-H.
Kay and I. We raised sheep.
Okay, is that 4-H. The Lewis?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think you're the first one we found that's been in 4-H, which is sort of amazing.
Oh, really? Boyd Benhink should have been.
We didn't ask.
Minimally, yes, involved.
And when you were in school, was there FFA class?
No, there was not. Okay. Now, when Dean was teaching at Rhonda County, they had a tremendous FFA program. We did have 4-H, and we did have, but we did not have an FFA program in school.
And you raised sheep.
Mm-hmm. Sheep or Odd Project. Yes, and, all right, to try to summarize, being a caregiver, as I have been these last 45 years, I see such a difference in children. When I was growing up, we played outside. You made up your play. Like I said, you built houses out of tumbleweed. You took sticks and you drew houses. We rode bikes. We climbed trees. Kids nowadays, everything is so programmed and set aside for them. They don't know how to play. And I look back on those days, when we just made up our own play and we just didn't have to have all these mechanized things to play with. It was such a wholesome experience. Mm-hmm. I had a teacher in college at K-State. It was a creative writing course that I was taking. And the very first thing that he did on the first day of every class was he challenged himself to go around the room and tell who came from the city and who came from the farm. He contended there was just such an altogether wholesomeness about the farm kids that exuded, and there was a streetwise sense that came from the city kid, and he was almost always wrong. I wouldn't change the life that I had for anything, because I really do think it just grounds you so. I wouldn't change the way my life was.
That's the next question here. Looking back overall, how do you think living in Edwards County affected your life? And I think you just said...
I wouldn't change it. I wouldn't change a thing. Even though my life was different, so to speak, the life's experience that I have had, good, bad, have made me who I am, and I wouldn't change a thing.
Okay, that we're sort of exploring the declining population after World War II. It's continued to decrease until, I guess, right now we're sort of leveling off. But how have you seen the declining population affect the life of people in Edwards County?
The younger people do not stay around. Farming is a very expensive adventure. And if you if you are not fortunate enough to have inherited some land or you have a way to get help to get some land, it's very expensive for young people to just get into. And they have found, you know, there is life outside of rural Kansas that appeals to so many. That's what I see, you know. It's just so much more difficult for kids to come back home to the farm unless there's an established family farm and a real desire to want to do it. And to knuckle down, it's hard work. You know, when you don't have a monthly paycheck coming in, you have to learn to live from crop to crop, season to season. Mm-hmm. And that's a hard adjustment to make.
What do you see for the future of Edwards County?
I hope the pendulum starts swinging back the other way. I truly do. You know, it's a great place to be and a great place to live. I can't imagine any place that has any more diverse elements to live in, mm-hmm. weather-wise. And, you know, it makes you strong, forms good character. I hope to see the pendulum swing back the other way. I truly do. With younger people coming and businesses coming.
I think that's a good place to stop.
Sounds think like, so?
Yeah, I think so.